with you. There are now 7 billion cell phones. Hopefully very soon there'll be 7 billion genomes.
Why my family? Why me? What did we do to deserve this?
We all have some nasty secrets in our genomes.
DNA secrets. We all have them.
Are you ready to find out yours?
I'm Kai Wright.
I'm Emma Keller.
From WNYC,
this is The Antidote.
Emma, if you want to know just how ubiquitous DNA testing is, you've got to meet Jared Rosenthal.
What's happening?
How you doing?
Jared.
I'm Kai. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. How are you?
He drives this giant blue truck all over New York City, like, you know, a food truck, but he's selling DNA tests. Now, this is not a subtle operation. On the side, in big cartoony graffiti-style letters, it says, "Who's your daddy?"
Yeah, that kind of breaks the ice with most people, you know?
I can imagine.
The comfort is our secret weapon. There's no white lab coats here, you know? You come on board, we're right out on the street, we're in your neighborhood, we're in the community.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah, but for around $350, he'll take a sample, send it to a lab where they'll figure out not just who's your daddy, but whether your twin is identical, whether you're really Puerto Rican or Italian.
The girl? Just the baby?
Oh, yeah, you do have to bring the child.
The baby live in Staten Island, man.
That's okay. I got wheels. We go there. No problem.
People kept coming up with all kinds of questions.
I want to prove to her that I wasn't my son before she passed.
I just want to know the truth.
The truth. You know, it seems like that's what everyone is looking for out of their DNA.
My dad just passed. We just buried him Monday. We
found out we
have a little brother. Little boy is 17 now.
This is Charlene. She came up at the end of the day. Her father had just died, and she was going through his contacts to notify everybody when she found this teenage boy who said he's her brother, her father's secret son. She wants to accept him into the family, and she's excited about it, but she needs genetic proof. Problem is, that's not so easy without the dad's DNA, too.
It's not guaranteed that you're going to get 100%, but...
telling you that he has my dad's genes, I already know.
So 85%, is there a number that's too low? It's too low of a percentage for you to say, okay.
Anything lower than 70, I wouldn't want to say you fell. 60, I could have stuck something in it, you know. My sweat could have fell in yours, you know. But no, at least 70 to 75%.
She's looking to science and DNA to help her make these big life choices for the truth. And Emma, that truth is about to get a lot more complicated because the kinds of labs that Jared uses are getting more sophisticated and able to use DNA to answer a huge variety of questions.
I think you're talking about labs like the New York Genome Center, that super modern DNA fortress that just opened up at the other end of the city. You definitely can't just walk up and ask questions here.
Help. Please identify yourself.
Emma Keller.
Please identify yourself.
How? I finally got upstairs to meet Dr. Robert Darnell, the president.
Are you Dr. Darnell?
Yes.
They showed me labs with dozens of robotic machines where they can sequence whole genomes in just 27 hours.
Those are the clinical sequencers. Each one costs $1 million.
Each fridge?
It's not a fridge.
Oh.
Ouch. That hurt.
The idea is to give you not just paternity and heritage, but all the health information hidden inside your DNA. Some of these genes are more predictive than others. Genes for breast cancer and Alzheimer's disease, for example, elevate your risk, but don't guarantee anything.
So who's going there? Who's getting these tests?
Well, for now, you have to be referred by your doctor, and it's not cheap, about $3,000 a test. But wait till you hear this, Kai. Eventually, they want to sequence the genome of every child born in New York.
I don't know if you're aware, but there's about 250,000 children born in New York State every year. And every single one of them gets their heel pricked and blood taken and tested with no consent, actually. It's just deemed to be in the common good. Those tests are very good, but they're not perfect.
He wants to expand those tests to include genes like BRCA1, which indicates a proclivity for breast and ovarian cancer.
But why would new parents want to know that their baby might develop breast cancer down the road?
I'm going to let the doctor speak to that.
When you actually sequence 10 people who have breast cancer, all 10 of them have different disease. So by taking an average cocktail to treat your tumor, you're getting something that is statistically good, but for you may not be so good.
So you see, Kai, the potential here is fantastic, a kind of personalized medicine. Last year I had breast cancer, and I considered having the BRCA gene test done after a double mastectomy. But I decided against it because I just didn't want that kind of information, which is unforgettable, hanging over my daughter's heads. But once I was in the Genome Center, I didn't feel frightened of knowing. I felt it was kind of exciting and empowering.
I just have so many questions about all of this still. Like, who has access to our genomes? How will it change other decisions we make in our lives? And will it bring us any closer to that truth that so many of us are looking for when we look to our genes?
Well, that's what we're focusing on today. Our DNA and what happens when its secrets are revealed.
Up first, a teenager uses DNA to track down a father who never wanted to be found. The ultimate Who's Your Daddy story and what it means for your privacy in the genetic age.
Then we'll take you inside one woman's quest to reveal her own genetic destiny. How DNA testing can reveal secrets the rest of your family might not want to know.
And what if your behavior can change how your genes are passed on? The brand new science that is changing how we think about DNA.
In the last century, you played everything without any respect for biology. And now finally we're coming back and saying, wait a minute, all these things might have consequences.
I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm Emma Keller.
Stay with us. You're listening to The Antidote, and we're talking about DNA. Okay, so more and more of us are getting genetically screened to figure out just how healthy we are. This is happening in a lot of different ways. Every newborn in the U.S. is screened for some diseases. Everyone in the military has their DNA collected for ID purposes and is screened for sickle cell. But this screening is getting more and more detailed, and that data isn't necessarily staying in one place. Scientific researchers are sharing genetic codes and research databases. Some people are even putting their own DNA information online to figure out how their genetic code measures up. So who's got access to all this information? Our reporter Mary Harris found a family with a story that has implications for all of us.
Lance was 38, single, living the life of a typical tech worker in California. Long days in Silicon Valley, ultimate frisbee and Bud Light on the weekends. And then he got this email.
Yeah, I mean, even remembering it now, my heart starts to pound a little bit.
The subject line, interesting information.
The email reads, Lance, where to begin? My name is Ryan Kramer. I'm 15 years old, and I live in Nederland, Colorado. 15 years ago, my mother was impregnated with a sperm donation from California Cryobank donor 1058. You may want to sit down for this next part. It's like a science fiction movie. Nobody emails you out of the blue to tell you you're their father.
But Ryan Kramer had done just that. Lance was that sperm donor, an anonymous sperm donor, who didn't particularly want to be found.
This came completely out of the blue.
Lance's son, Ryan, who was just 15 at the time, had found a way to reverse engineer vast amounts of public DNA information, using his genetic code in a way that had never been done before. Ryan had been asking about his father for more than a decade.
I feel like my curiosity came in waves throughout my upbringing. So there was always like this real desire to see a picture or to meet this person.
For Ryan's mother, Wendy, it was more than that. As a single mom, helping her son find his father had become a kind of duty.
I felt like I owed it to him. I brought him into the world with that particular set of circumstances, and I felt like it was my responsibility then to help him find the answers he was looking for. He might not find them, but I was going to die trying for him.
Wendy spent nearly a decade helping Ryan dig up clues.
So I would call the sperm bank like every year, every couple of years.
She had some basics. The cryobank identified Ryan's father as donor 1058.
And this one time when I called, somebody there inadvertently told me that there were at least, I think at that point, either 3 or 9 half-brothers and sisters out there. And I thought, oh God, you know, as soon as I tell Ryan, of course he's going to say, okay, when can I meet them?
Knowing that there were half-siblings out there, other people who might be looking for donor 1058 sparked an idea for Wendy and Ryan. What if they could connect with these genetic brothers and sisters? This was in 2000. The internet was still something many of us connected to using a dial-up modem. But Wendy started a Yahoo group. She called it the Donor Sibling Registry. It was a place where donor kids like Ryan could log on and share information in the hopes of finding their fathers.
So basically, we created a place where you could be found if people were looking for you. If there are donors who want to know any of the children they've helped to create, why shouldn't they have a way to make mutual consent contact.
For a month or two, Wendy and Ryan were the only people logged in. But soon, the donor sibling registry began to attract attention.
Ryan set off on a mission to find his donor dad.
A story in the local news led to calls from Good Morning America, Oprah, 60 Minutes.
Ryan Kramer stepped out of the shadows.
And all that publicity helped Wendy and Ryan's file folder on 1058 get fatter.
Anywhere that we could possibly gather any sort of additional information that could eventually help us figure out who he was, it's sort of something we did.
They even did a public record search for all the men born on their donor's birthday in their donor's birth city.
And we got back this list of, it was probably about 350 people. And we thought, you know, there's a pretty good chance that one of these guys is my donor.
This is kind of intense.
Yeah, it was a lot like sleuthing, yeah.
And this is where DNA made all the difference. Because all that sleuthing, the television appearances, the internet activism, all of it would have been useless if Ryan hadn't found his way to an online DNA database. You may have heard of some of these databases, like the website 23andMe. It gives you personalized health information. Ryan sent a sample of his saliva to a website that promises to uncover your genetic ancestry. For $99, they'll tell you if you're Native American. Make it $169, they'll check if you're a distant relative of Thomas Jefferson. He didn't expect much.
But one of the other features that this website had was this sort of relative finder type of feature where it would notify you if anybody else was related to you.
Sure enough, he began to connect with distant family. And the two men who were Ryan's closest genetic relatives had something else in common, a last name. Remember, Wendy and Ryan had done that public record search. And because last names are passed from father to son, father to son.
One of us had a thought. I wonder, on that list of all the males born on that day in that county that your donor's name is on, I wonder if there's anyone on that list with that last name.
Lance was the only match.
At that point, we're sort of dumbfounded. Like, is this your donor? Oh, my God.
Lance had never put his own DNA online. None of his close relatives had either. But just a snippet of shared genetic code from distant cousins with a common last name was enough to reveal his identity. For Ryan and Wendy, their research proves that at least for sperm donors, the notion of privacy may be obsolete.
I think it's kind of ridiculous that we're still promising donors that they'll be anonymous or that if they choose to never be found, they can't, because there's always the possibility that at some point somebody's going to come knocking and, you know, sort of like I did, want some answers.
My favorite one is number 5 here with a 15-year-old kid.
George Church is a geneticist at Harvard. Here he is at a conference on innovation in 2010.
Found his surname, found his father on the first shot.
He tells the story of Lance and Ryan a lot, and he says the implications go far beyond sperm donors. Because the rapid growth of DNA testing may make privacy more elusive for all of us.
If a 15-year-old boy can do it, then anybody can do it. This kid had an unfair advantage in that he knew himself. He could analyze his own DNA. But I think increasingly that's going to be possible to figure that out for people, even people that you don't know.
But Church thinks losing a little privacy might make all of us a lot healthier.
Privacy is kind of a new invention. It's not something that's been with us forever. You know, if you go to tribes even today or even small towns today, pretty much everybody knows everything, right? You don't want your privacy to be held against you. If no one knows that you've got something unusual going on, then you're not going to be helped. So if there are lots of computers crawling around looking at your data, then there's a chance they'll catch something that you didn't catch.
Back in California, Ryan's father, Lance, is still trying to make up his mind about the benefits and risks of being genetically outed. He's gotten used to having a son.
He's my donor offspring, and he's a great kid. He's my younger half-clone.
But Lance knows he has other children out there. And even though he's been identified already, he asked us not to use his last name. He's not sure how many more kids he wants tracking him down.
It is very difficult to imagine that anyone will be able to keep their DNA lineage anonymous. It's something we're going to live with in the future. We're living with today, apparently.
Mary Harris joins us in the studio now. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Okay, Mary, so George Church says privacy is a new invention, and it is, but isn't it a good one? To me, data, DNA, all of this is just data until it's applied. My face is just my face until somebody puts it on a poll and says I committed a crime. And privacy is the thing that protects me from that kind of malicious application. So is that gone now in the era of DNA?
Church says it is. He runs his own database, and he takes a completely different approach. He says he can't protect you, and he fully informs his subjects beforehand, saying, you could have family you don't know about tracking you down. You could find out medical information about yourself that you don't actually want to know. And the thing that's really interesting to me is that in the future, we won't need these databases. As the sequencing technology gets cheaper and cheaper, you can sequence anyone. Right now in the studio, I'm leaving DNA on my chair. I could leave the studio. You could pick up a hair, put it in a computer, figure out a whole lot about me.
I could know everything I ever wanted to know about Mary Harris.
Exactly.
But Mary, who cares if somebody knows your genetic information? What's the worst thing that could happen?
What's scary is that we have no idea. So I said before, George Church fully informs anyone who joins his database that their privacy could be violated. And one of the really extreme examples he gives about what could happen with your DNA is that someone could replicate it, sequence it, and place it at a crime scene. All of a sudden, you're a suspect in a crime you had nothing to do with. It's an extreme example, but it really gets your mind thinking about what could be the new normal.
Or insurance companies could decide that my rate depends on what kind of DNA I have.
So right now there actually is legislation that theoretically protects you against that. It's called GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. But we don't really know how protective it is because the DNA technology is really just reaching the market. So we're going to find out a lot over the coming years about just how protective it is.
Okay, so we're all kind of freaked out about the future. But has anybody else done this kind of thing? Has anybody else done what Ryan did?
Yes. So Ryan and Wendy are obviously really connected in the donor community. They know a lot of other siblings and donor kids. And they've actually started teaching people how to do exactly what they did. And they've been doing it on a one-on-one basis. But coming out this fall, they're going to have a show on MTV where they literally follow a woman through the process of trying to track down her donor father using the exact same process that Ryan did. So a lot more people are going to know about it. I think that genetic privacy is still something we can debate for most of us. But if you're a sperm donor, I don't know that you can really say that your genetic information is private anymore.
All right, Mary. Well, thanks.
Thanks, Mary.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Antidote. I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm Emma Keller. So, Kai, listening to you so far, it seems like you're pretty skeptical about the benefits of genetic testing.
Maybe a little.
Well, let me introduce you to someone else. Someone who couldn't imagine not getting a genetic test.
Okay.
Her name's Kelly. She's 28 years old, and Huntington's disease runs in her family.
So, what does that mean?
Well, Huntington's is completely genetic. Kelly's mom has it, which means that Kelly has a 50-50 chance of getting it herself, and it's devastating. You get physical symptoms that are a lot like Parkinson's. You tremble, you shake, your body almost dances. And you also become mentally ill with symptoms like those of Alzheimer's or schizophrenia. All of this usually happens in your 30s or 40s, but you can live like that for decades.
That's really young. But right now, most genetic tests will only give you sort of an odds ratio of whether you'll get sick, right?
The test for Huntington's is actually one of the most definitive out there. If you test positive, you'll get the disease. Kelly's decided she wants to know. She's the youngest of six sisters, but the only one who's chosen to get the test so far. She kept a radio diary throughout the whole process. Here's her story.
It's 8:30 in the morning. I have an hour and a half until my results, and I'm getting ready. I feel nervous. I'm nervous today. I was a little nervous last night. Started to kick in about midnight. And today I'm like, I can't explain it. It's like butterflies, like that, in your stomach.
I'm holding us up. I'm holding us up. I'm cooking breakfast, and we gotta leave.
I'm 28 years old. I live in Levittown, PA. I live here with my fiancé, Kyle.
I'm trying to avoid this.
I've decided to get tested now because I'm in a serious relationship. I want to move forward in my life, and I have to prepare the right way. Whether it be a negative or a positive result, I need to know what I have to do from this point on. My mom has Huntington's disease. Her father had Huntington's disease. No kid should ever have to see the shit that went down in my house when we were kids. like crazy stuff. Like came home one day and everything was in plastic bags. Everything was contaminated and disgusting. And she was allergic to everything. It was like something just a kid doesn't need to see or go through. I am here with my sister, and we're going to ask her a few questions. My oldest sister, Kathy, who's 42 years old, was the one that took care of my mother when she started to get very sick. She's showing symptoms of the disease. How are you feeling now?
Good.
How did you feel before? We'll say a month ago.
A month ago? Horrible. Feels like your mind is going. It's just, you try to think and your body doesn't allow it to think. It's like you can't remember. It's just it seems like you're overtired and your brain just won't let your body do what it needs to do. And you look at something and you're like, okay, I know how to do this. Like, I know it. And you can't do it. And then it's kind of like you wake up confused and try to, like, you know you have to go to the bathroom, but you can't make it fast enough.
So then you would pee yourself?
Yeah, that happened. Yeah, that happened recently. It runs big time in our family.
Our grandfather,
I think he had 5 brothers, I think. So
they all got it?
Yeah, they all got it.
See, that's scary to me, because that's not 50-50 at all. So now, another question I want to ask. Why haven't you ever gotten tested? Like, why didn't you think, even now, what was your biggest fear?
The denial of wasting my life.
Like, you feel like you didn't do what you should have done.
Yeah, like I should have lived more.
I don't know if I'll be liberated if they tell me I have it, because, like you said, you think about it every day, and if you know you have it, like you said, I'm going to live balls to the wall. I'm going to do everything. I'm going to make a list and do everything I want to do.
Mm-hmm. None of us should be having kids.
The one main reason I won't have a kid is because I don't want to pass it on. For me, it's not even that. It's more so the care of the child. Now, I don't want my kid to go through what I went through. I had you to raise me, thank God, but... Mm-hmm. With mommy, like, I saw the most terrible part of someone that was supposed to be my mother.
That's why I didn't want Kayla taking care of me, because I did it with mommy.
Yeah, it's so hard. Like, with Kayla, so if Kayla has it, what would you feel?
Like shit, yeah, I feel guilty.
I don't feel like you have it, Kel. I don't think you do.
My niece Kayla's here with me today because she's going to come with me to come get my results.
I hope I'm right.
Flattering thought.
My name is Kayla. I'm 21 years old. My mom is Kathy, and she currently, you know, we think she has Huntington's. I had gotten tested already, and I do have the gene, just not displaying, like, signs yet, like physical signs. I decided not to tell my mom. When I was getting tested, you know, I asked them about, you know, if I should tell her, and they said one of her defense mechanisms coping with her Huntington's is that she doesn't believe she has it. I don't want her to feel guilty for me having it, because I can see, like, how that would devastate her, and she's already depressed and, you know, on edge, and I wouldn't want to, like, you know, push her over. There's one part of me that if Kelly has it, I'm not alone. But one part, if she doesn't have it, I say, why me? Basically, I'd feel kind of like grateful that she doesn't have it, but really sad that I'm alone in it. But at least I have her to take care of me, so it's okay.
All right, here we go. We're going, getting in the car, getting ready to leave. Babe, if I do get sick, just make sure you do my hair. Like, brush my hair, and don't cut it short. Short hair, like my mom. I did that to my mom. I hate short hair.
Honestly, it sucks. I hate saying it, but both outcomes are, like, still kind of
shitty.
No, good for Kayla.
Yeah, they're both good
for
me.
She's got somebody to party with if she gets sick, and if not, she thinks that you're going to take care of her.
So, either, that's what I feel bad about. Like, either way, it's, like, good news for me. Not good news, but... See, I'm cold. Like, just stick me in a nursing home. I'll be fine.
We'll settle you in nicely.
I'll make friends. I'll make friends.
made friends. She loved the assisted living place. Remember she had a boyfriend there?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
He was blind, but he was a good guy. I gotta go in there. What time is it? Wait. Oh, shit. Shit's getting real now. Okay, it is 5 after 10. We are waiting in the waiting room to go see Shayna for my results.
Shall we?
Yes.
Right here, number 1 on the Caltech.
Okay.
Your results were normal. You're not going to have Huntington's disease. So it's not what you were expecting, I know.
See, I told you.
Oh my god. Oh my god. I'm sorry.
Okay. I knew you did it.
I can't even believe this. Like, are you sure?
I'll show you the paper. I can show you the word. Right there, the negative. So negative is normal.
Can we have that?
Absolutely. I do need to make a photocopy, but you can absolutely have it.
Oh my god, I was so sick over this.
And, you know, a lot of people think that just normal is easy and everything's good, but it's complicated.
You mind if I just step outside?
No, go ahead.
That's fine. Okay.
It probably wasn't a good idea for her to be here. Not that I think about it. Like, I wanted her for her support, but then it seems like she's probably going to be upset about it.
You don't have it.
I can't believe it.
Do you
want to
have a baby?
Yeah, I have a baby. I want a normal life. I need a normal life.
A normal life. This one test result is letting her think about living a life she never thought she'd be able to lead. We'll be right back. Coming up, we'll check in and see how Kelly is doing a week after that genetic test.
And what if your behavior can change how your genes are passed on? I'll introduce you to an obesity surgeon whose genetic research has given him some extreme opinions.
I would like to prevent obese, reproductive age women from conceiving as long as they're obese.
You're listening to The Antidote, and today we're talking all about DNA. Kai, one thing I can't help but notice in all of our stories so far, even if people are getting genetically tested to find out about their health, so much of this process is about family.
Right. Like Kelly, who was getting screened for Huntington's, her whole family was invested in the results, her sister, her niece.
And she'd never even considered having kids if she tested positive.
Right.
But what if I told you our DNA might be a bit flexible, that all of us might be able to influence the way our kids' genetic codes work, just by how we live our lives?
Okay, I'm listening.
Let me take you across the river to Brooklyn for a minute.
Hello, I'm Emma Keller. Nice to meet you.
This is Dr. John Kral. He's not a geneticist, he's an obesity surgeon. But he's been studying women who get weight loss surgery long term to see how healthy they and their families are. What he's found is that after women have weight loss surgery, the DNA that they pass on to their children is different.
An obese mother, her kid, when she's obese, is likely to have some genes that function in an obese way.
When she's no longer obese,
those genes have changed back to what they should be normally.
Wait a minute. So how is surgery impacting DNA?
Well, obviously, once the women have had the surgery, they're healthier. They've lost weight, they're less likely to get diabetes, and those health benefits seem to be conveyed to their children. So the children who are born to the mothers after they've had weight loss surgery are healthier in all those ways.
And this is all visible at the genetic level.
Yeah, it's part of an entirely new field of genetics called epigenetics. The theory is that the changes are actually happening in a sort of chemical process that occurs around conception. It influences how genes are expressed. I should say researchers don't think this is just about women, Kai. Environmental influences may be piling up in a man's DNA too. But these results have taken Dr. Kral to an extreme place.
I would like to prevent obese, reproductive age women from conceiving as long as they're obese. Because it's so dangerous for their health, and they're dooming the next generation.
Are you being serious? Because it's quite out there to say you want to prevent obese women from reproducing. Maybe you'd like to say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that you'd like to educate obese women about the risks that are involved in reproducing at a certain weight.
I'm all about educating, but sometimes teaching isn't enough.
Wow, that's contentious stuff.
That's Professor Keith Godfrey in the UK. I called him because I was so shocked by what Kral had to say. Godfrey does agree that obese women endanger their children, but he's actually achieved the same results as Kral, healthier kids, by changing a pregnant woman's diet. He says that even eating the wrong combinations of food while pregnant can have health consequences for your kids.
Even in women with a normal body mass index, there are nutritional influences that alter the children's susceptibility to obesity later on.
So we're talking about everybody here. This is not just obese women. Anybody, what you eat is going to affect your kids' genes.
The research is very new here, but Godfrey even talks about the kind of food you eat influencing your children. I thought he'd say, oh, cut down on sugar, cut down on carbs. But actually what he says is, a high-protein, low-carb diet like the Atkins diet, if a woman eats that in the first trimester of pregnancy, her children will be heavier.
Okay, so this still all raises a lot of questions for me. So we're going to bring in another expert here from McGill University, Dr. Moshe Ziff.
Yes, I'm here.
So here's what we're trying to understand. We've been told that your behavior can now impact your genes, which is totally counterintuitive to me. Can you help us understand exactly how does that work?
Right. What we are saying is that behavior can impact how the genes function. We inherit from our parents, you know, the DNA, which is the letters of life. Letters by itself don't create a language. You need punctuation marks to create a language. The punctuation marks are laid on the DNA separately. When a baby comes out to the world, he has the DNA that he inherited, which has the basic letters, and the punctuation, which developed during gestation. Signals that come during gestation and later in life could alter those punctuation marks and thus change the gene function.
So what kind of signals? Well, what does that mean?
The signals could be food, stress, physical signals, like how much light there is, how long the day is.
We've been talking about this in terms of obesity, but it sounds like this is true for a whole bunch of health outcomes, that this programming of genes that can happen in the womb can end up changing a variety of things that happen once you're born, right?
Right. Because, you know, our genes define everything we're going to do in our life. And so the way we program them will define everything we're going to do. Are we going to be, anxious or not? Are we going to have high or low cognitive ability? So you can think about any human function has to be programmed.
Anything we do, we can be reprogrammed.
Anything we do has to be programmed and adapted to the world we live in.
You know, I think about when does the obese mom become the new crack mom?
I want to emphasize these are not bad or good things necessarily, right? So binging, which in our comfortable world of Western Europe or North America is a very detrimental, an adverse phenotype, because it will cause us to be obese. If you lived in the jungle where you had a meal once every month, that will save your life. So these are not evil processes. They are physiological processes. However, we have changed the world in such a way that I think we kind of outpaced evolution.
Why does it bother me so much to hear that I should think about my genes differently than I have in the past?
I think that to a large extent, modern genetics freed us from the bonds of religion, which always has put guilt on us and tried to show us that we are responsible for everything and we are accountable for everything. So in the last century, you played with everything. We played with family, we played with neighborhood, we played with everything we can touch without any respect for, you know, biology. And now finally we're coming back and saying, wait a minute, all these things might have consequences. That puts a huge burden on our shoulders again.
Because we've got all these choices to make now.
Yes, there are choices to make, and these choices have consequences, and we should think about them.
Well, thank you for joining us, Dr. Ziff.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Moshe Ziff of McGill University.
So, Kai, why does this bother you? I think it's optimistic that we can change our genes.
Well, I think it's the societal choices it presents that give me pause. I mean, we're talking about diseases that have been firmly established to correlate very closely with stuff like race and class. Diabetes, heart disease, these are things that we've seen African Americans are more likely to have, people who are poor are more likely to have, people who live in the South are more likely to have. And so the question is, what are we going to do about that? Dr. Ziff raises the interesting point that part of the external signals that are sent to the child are the environment in which a mother lives. So if a mother lives in poverty and is stressed, she's sending stress to her child. If a mother lives in a food desert and can't get good food, she's sending bad food to her child. So are we going to fix – is this going to make us fix those environmental signals, or is this going to make us just blame the mom for sending those signals?
Well, I hear what you're saying there, because the one thing that made me uneasy about all of this, obviously, was when Dr. Kral was saying that his agenda was to prevent obese women from reproducing, because that made me think of the times when I was pregnant and I was told, you know, you don't drink coffee, you don't have a glass of wine, you don't have sushi, you don't eat soft cheese. And that was conveyed to me as, if you do, you're a bad mom. But on the whole, I think it's really optimistic that we can maybe change things for future generations so that our grandkids won't have the same health issues that our grandparents did.
Well, we're going to wade into some of this sticky territory when we get back. What are the new ethical questions of the genetic era? Stay with us. Baby, what you get your body from? Tell me what you get your body from.
So, Kai, we've heard all these stories about what you can learn from genetic testing. Have any of them convinced you to get tested yourself?
I'm still uneasy about it.
Well, maybe our next guest can help. We're joined now by Nita Farahani. She's a professor of bioethics at Duke University. Also on the line, Hank Greeley from Stanford University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, guys, Kai is unconvinced he should get his genome sequenced.
I don't know what I'm going to get out of it. I fear the unknown part of it. And Nita, I want you to convince me. What should I get my genome sequenced? Why? Is it going to make me healthier?
Let me ask you a question, which is, if somebody says to you, I have good news and bad news, which one do you want first?
I want the bad news first. I do.
To get it over with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if there's bad news, you do want to know it, even if you can't necessarily do anything about it, I assume, in other contexts in life, right?
Most.
Like, you don't like to live in ignorance of...
Yes. I do not choose to have my head in the sand most of the time, just on my genes.
Right. If you're somebody who doesn't like to have their head in the sand all the time, then I'd say get your head out of the sand and get tested, because there's a wealth of knowledge that you can learn from your genetic profile. And some of it is actionable, meaning that there are things that you can immediately do to improve your life, even things like testing for Alzheimer's, which most people agree right now there is very little, if anything, that you can do that's actionable about. You might do things like plan your estate differently or have an advanced psychiatric directive that would guide your future care. You're simply better off knowing.
Hank?
Often I think people don't adequately understand the consequences of getting tested. Like all information, genetic information has some positive uses and can have some harms. If, for example, a woman learns she doesn't have the BRCA1 or BRCA2 pathogenic mutations, disease-causing, breast and ovarian cancer-causing, and so she's not at, say, 80% risk of getting breast cancer, and so decides, oh, good, I don't need to get mammograms anymore, that could be a fatal mistake, because her risk has gone from roughly the population level 12% all the way down to about 11.95%.
Do you feel, either of you, that a couple who are planning on having children together should each get genetically screened and share their information to see what that might generate?
I think a couple planning to get pregnant should have the option of doing preconception screening. I don't think it should be mandatory.
On my husband and I's third date, we shared with each other our complete 23andMe genetic profiles. including what 23andMe reports out as our carrier status for various different types of conditions. And we were both really interested. And we were both really interested not just because of mere entertainment and curiosity, but because we both recognize that genetics do play a role, although not in many cases a determinative role in behavior. And we're both interested in having children. And so it was something that was valuable to us. But I don't think it's valuable to everybody. And many people think that my husband and I are quite strange for even having done that kind of exchange, particularly so early on.
Did you find out anything worrying?
Well, I married him, so not worrying enough.
So, guys, we also talked about epigenetics, the idea that you can change your genes or the way your genes are programmed through behavior. We talked specifically about pregnant moms. If they get thinner, they can pass on better genes to their children. This raises a whole bunch of questions, most obviously moral questions for the mother.
Epigenetics has been a very hot buzzword in the genetics world for several years. Epigenetics clearly happens. The issue of inherited epigenetics, of changes from the parents passed on to the children, is much more controversial.
Is it amoral for you to not get thin if you're pregnant?
Most women are interested in having children who are as healthy as possible.
It's not a new set of questions. We know that mothers who drink to excess during pregnancy raise health issues for their children. We know that mothers who smoke during pregnancy raise health issues for their children. If, in fact, there are epigenetic contributions to it as well, I don't think they're different from those other environmental effects during pregnancy.
Nita, I gather from your discussion earlier that you believe that everyone should be getting tested. It's in the greater good of society for us all to know. Is that accurate? And if so, why?
The more people realize that genetic information isn't exceptional, that everybody's genetic sequence has many different predispositions for things that might be terrible, we stop living in fear and paralysis of what genetic information is, and we stop treating it as this truly exceptional piece of information.
Don't you both feel that we're inevitably headed that way anyway? There will come a time where we do actually know everything about ourselves and about each other, and that we should just stop worrying and face it.
Yes, I do think it's inevitable that sequencing is going to become much more commonplace. It's going to be a long time before we understand what all of those sequences mean.
Hank?
And even when we understand what all those sequences mean, we are not just our genes. We are our genes plus all of our experiences, all of our parents' experiences, all of our environmental influences from culture and otherwise. And another big factor that's often overlooked, all of the good and bad luck that happens to us. So genes are not our essence. Genes do not define us. They are one more piece of information.
That was Hank Greeley of Stanford University and Nita Farahani of Duke University. You hear that, Emma? After this whole show, maybe genes are not the be-all and end-all?
Maybe. They certainly were for Kelly, who kept that radio diary for us earlier in the show.
It's been almost a week since she learned she was negative for the Huntington's gene.
We have her on the line now. Kelly, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Has it sunk in yet?
Not really. It's very slow. I notice like every day I have like a little bit more of, oh my God, it's really true. I think it's just the same as getting a positive result. It kind of just takes time to kind of retrain yourself. Since I can remember, I've always had a plan for the way that I was going to live my life, seeing that I was going to be sick at 35. So I kind of, honestly, like, I don't know, hopefully over time it'll go away, but like I still have a hard time picturing myself getting old and having kids and, living like a normal life like most people do. That's the toughest part, I think, of having the negative result is you just thought one way for so long, and it's like that's not how it's going to be, you know? Like, I think about, like, oh, God, I can be pregnant, and it's just, like, weird. It's so strange. You know, normal people think about your house, your family. I thought about, like, literally I'm scoping out nursing homes. Like, every time, like, you go to a nursing home for somebody's family, or like, you're like, oh, is this a nice one? Should I go here? Like, that was my future. Like, my thought was, how can I comfortably die, like, and not, mess up somebody else's life? It's just that was my future, just getting crazy and getting sick, and you just didn't have, like, what you guys, most people who aren't sick think about. I didn't have that thought at all.
Did Do you actually feel like a healthy person now?
Yeah, it's really funny. I said that. Like, I always felt like I was twitching or, like, because that's some of the symptoms. And I was like, it's so amazing that I don't notice that anymore.
Right, and that happened straight away.
Yeah, it's like right away. That was like instant. Like, sometimes I'll do it, like, I'll twitch and I'll be like, oh, no, can't think that way now. You know, like, it happened like once or twice. But overall, like, I'm not kidding you. My day was consumed with any little twitch I had.
Have you felt able to celebrate?
No, not really. life still happens, you know. You still go to work and you still have stuff to do. And, you know, I went up to my family's that weekend and it was like, when your whole family is at risk, it's almost like people want to be happy for you, but then they're not because they're still at risk.
Right.
So, like, yeah. a lot, and I didn't tell anyone really that I was going, and, you know, one of my sisters was pissed off at me because I didn't tell her I went, and I didn't celebrate for sure. Like,
how's your niece Kayla doing? She, of course, still has the gene.
I felt terrible for her. You know, I'm screaming because I'm so happy, and she was crying. So it was hard. She was quiet about it. She really, like, that day, she was kind of quiet and didn't say much about it. Kayla ended up telling her mother, too, that over the weekend, and she was having, you know, some mixed emotions about that, too. And honestly, since she went home, I haven't really heard from her, and that's, like, not like her. Usually she'll call me 4 or 5 wow. times a day. I think she's kind of in the same situation that I'm in, you know, just kind of wrapping your head around it.
Right.
And I don't want to push it. She'll talk to me when she's ready, you know.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with it, Kelly, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us and being here.
Yep, thank you. I appreciate it.
You know, Emma, for me, we talk to a lot of people, but Kelly is the most convincing reason to get a genetic test, because it's not just about me. It's about the people around me, the people who take care of us, everyone in our lives.
We want to know what you think. If listening to these stories has changed your mind about getting a genetic test, let us know. Head to WNYC.org and leave a comment for us. And join me at theguardian.com for a live chat with Dr. Bob Darnell on October 31st at 1 p.m.
That's our show. Talk to you soon. Special thanks to Susan and Peter Solomon, whose generous support made our reporting possible.